Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette dated Wednesday, August the 5th, 2026. Today on the front page is a colorful picture of some young football players in front of the News Gazette building. And the heading says, Westville offensive lineman Reed Smith, coach Guy Goodlove, and quarterback Easton Bolin show off their enthusiasm as the News Gazette Vice President of News, Jim Rossow, records a video Tuesday at the Newsboy statue outside of the News Gazette offices in South Champaign. The visit by Goodlove, the area dean of high school football coaches who is entering his 32nd season in charge of the Tigers, and two of his seniors came on the last day of the 7-day high school football media days event at the News Gazette. All told, 33 area programs took part in the 5th annual event before the first day of practice gets going today. For the majority of area teams, the season kicks off on August 21st. And there's more, of course, in the sports section. Let's keep going here on the front page with an article from the Champaign County Court by Luke Taylor with the heading, Man with Felony Record Found Guilty of Having Gun. Arrest stemmed from high-speed chase in 2024. A Champaign man has been found guilty of being a felon in possession of a firearm as a result of his arrest following a high-speed chase that led to the lockdown of an elementary school in 2024. Travoy Fonville, 30, opted not to testify during his trial, which took only a single day. Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson reminded the jury that this case was simply about firearm possession. Both sides agreed that Fonville had a record, including felonies, and most other surrounding details were irrelevant, Larson said. On October 31, 2024, Champaign's Booker T. Washington STEM Academy was placed on a soft lockdown due to nearby police activity. A high-speed chase that led officers from multiple agencies across town made district officials concerned enough to impose the lockdown until Champaign police provided clearance. The incident started when one officer who testified at the Tuesday trial watched someone get into a car while holding a firearm. He was fairly sure that he recognized the person and knew that they are not to be allowed to have a weapon. In the process of following the vehicle to investigate, the officer had the license plate investigated and determined the car belonged to Fonville, who also is not allowed to own a firearm. Police stopped the vehicle, but the driver suddenly took off, beginning a pursuit that reached speeds of up to 65 miles per hour in a work zone where the posted limit was 20 miles per hour. Larson presented footage and stills from squad car dash cameras recording the chase, including an image of Fonville's vehicle going over the embankment around the Stride Center on the north end of downtown Champaign, which is a testifying officer estimated was about 5 feet high. Eventually, police said the vehicle came to a stop due to apparent mechanical failures, at which point all four of its occupants got out and ran. Footage from another testifying officer's body camera showed that one of those who fled tossing firearms over the fence of a yard that he ran by. The officer could be heard yelling and telling others over the radio that he would circle back to find the guns later. After a few minutes, he circled back and retrieved the guns. No firearms were seen directly in Fonville's hands or found in his flight path, but DNA that a forensic scientist said it was his, found on one of the guns. After he was apprehended, Fonville told officers that he was not aware of any firearms in the vehicle with him and that he did not even know who his passengers were. He said he met them at either a gas station or a liquor store and was giving them a ride to be nice. He also told them that the reason he fled was that police had been harassing him. Larson argued that no one would drive like that unless they knew there was something that they could get in trouble for. He also said that if those people really were strangers, they would have been going to police to accuse Fonville of being insane for his driving. Fonville's attorney, Hallie Besner, said these arguments were not supported by fact and that the state had not proved that Fonville knew anyone else in the vehicle. She also called into question the reliability of the DNA evidence after a typo was found in the forensic scientist's report, even after going through standard peer review. Even if Fonville did know the people in the vehicle had guns, Besner said that that didn't mean he was in possession of the weapons. Larson claimed that the man who allegedly threw the guns into another yard, later identified as William Laws, 27, of Champaign, clearly had just been carrying one firearm in his hoodie and tight pants, and took Fonville's because he was busy driving. A third man arrested in the incident, Anthony Wilkins, 31, of Rantoul, pleaded guilty to unlawful possession of a weapon last summer and was sentenced to 11 years in prison. Moving on to another article, this time from Urbana, from the Urbana City Council, by Jana Wiersema, with the title, Ordinance Requiring Approval for Surveillance Tools Passes. On December 16, 2024, Alderwoman Grace Wilkin and then Alderwoman Jaya Colasetti presented a draft ordinance to create an approval process and reporting requirements for surveillance technologies used by the Urbana Police Department. 20 months and several revisions later, the City Council has approved the final version of the ordinance, which applies to surveillance tools used by any and all city departments. The ordinance, which requires council approval for any use surveillance technologies as well as those already in use, was approved in a 6-1 vote. Alderwoman Cherise Hersey, the lone no, said she could not vote for it in good conscience, as she feared it may have negative ripple effects for people of color, low-income individuals, and those who need such technology to rid our neighborhoods of dope dealers, drug shooting galleries, gun runners, and possible human traffickers, and those that prey on the vulnerable citizens of Urbana. Prior to the final vote Monday night, she spent 12 minutes detailing her concerns. Among other things, Hersey said, while she isn't against having city departments create policies for the surveillance technologies that they use, she believes that the ordinance may cause more harm than good with regard to public safety. I am sure that some may be thinking that you're saving black and poor folk from the systematic racism and terror that has endured for generations in these communities, she said. But from my perspective and those of some of my constituents, you're just updating it. Let's continue on in our communities in section A6 with an article by Jana Wiersema from Champaign about reading councils with the heading Images in Children's Literature to be the Focus of Discussion. The Illini and Vermilion Valley Reading Councils are partnering to present an event on the impact of images in literature written for children and adolescents. Responding to the visual, the juxtaposition of image and text in picture books and graphic books will take place from 10:30 a.m. to noon on August 15th at Barnes & Noble, 65 East Market View Drive in Champaign. The event will feature speakers Carla Moeller and Ashley Dawson. Moeller is the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs in Education at the University of Illinois and an authority on culturally inclusive children's books, organizers said. She also taught grades 4-6 and worked with kids and adults of all ages during her teaching and research. Dawson is a doctoral candidate at the U of I with a focus on supporting teachers' use of authentic literature that features LGBTQ perspectives. Her experience includes teaching high school and college students and using literature while working with children and adults. Carla and Ashley will share examples of image-rich picture books and graphic books that engage children and adolescents and invite reflection on diverse themes through visual storytelling, organizers said. They will explore how responding to visuals enhance enjoyment, comprehension, and self-expression across ages, and will lead a discussion about the interplay of image and text in visually rich books from early readers through adolescence. Additionally, attendees will be invited to share their own recommendations. A link to a Google form to RSVP can be found at illinoisreadingcouncil.org/Illini. And then there's another article on this page with the heading Capital News Illinois, and this is from Springfield by Ben Zielinski, with the heading, New Law to Regulate Social Media's Interactions with Kids, but it doesn't take effect until 2028. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed sweeping regulations aimed at social media companies and cracking down on addictive algorithms that keep kids glued to their screens. House Bill 5511, known as the Children's Social Media Safety Act, imposes a series of requirements on social media companies and how they are to interact with users under 18 years old. The law, which will take effect in 2028, was one of Pritzker's top priorities during the spring legislative session and received unanimous support in both chambers. Big social media companies have intentionally designed their platforms to keep kids online for as long as possible, Pritzker said. Their algorithms learn what captures a child's attention and which most often seems to be anger and euphoria, and then the algorithm keeps feeding them more of it. Why? The almighty dollar. They feed our kids an unrealistic picture of life and sell them products and agendas to achieve it. Under the law, social media platforms must confirm a user's age through the device's operating system. When devices are set up for children, parents would set the child's age, which would automatically trigger certain restrictions required by the state. To limit the addictive nature of social media feeds, the law prohibits companies from using a minor's viewing history or data stored on the device to determine what shows up in their feeds. Instead, feeds for minors will be allowed to only show information the user requested or searched for, or was posted by a creator the user follows. Kids also will be able to see media that is a direct private message to them. These are common sense protections, Pritzker said. They don't prevent young people from connecting with one another or their loved ones online. They don't censor anyone. They take decisions about children's online safety away from the companies and put them back in the hands of parents. Stronger default privacy settings are also required for minors, including shielding a minor's precise location and limited digital currency transactions. Social media sites and apps would also be prohibited from sending notifications to minors between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. What we're seeing is shrinking attention spans, rising depression rate, and in kids, sacrificing sleep to scroll long past when they should be asleep. It's a real danger, said House Bill sponsor Jennifer Gong Gershowitz, a Democrat from Glenview. The Illinois Attorney General's office would enforce the law. Violators would be liable for fines up to $2,500 for each child for unintentional violations and up to $7,500 per child for intentional violations. It is important that we balance the guardrails that keep young people safe, guardrails that technology companies should have implemented from the very beginning, Attorney General Kwame Rawl said. Rawl has joined lawsuits against both Meta and TikTok, alleging the companies have addictive designs that exploit children. The law was generally opposed by tech companies. During testimony in committees this spring, lobbyists for the companies raised concern that the bill would violate First Amendment rights and potentially trigger lawsuits against the state. The final version of the bill was opposed by the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, the Motion Picture Association, tech company advocacy organization TechNet, and the American Civil Liberties Union. Innovation and child safety are not competing interests, said Senate bill sponsor Willie Preston, a Democrat from Chicago. You do not have to choose between technological progress and protecting children. The greatest innovations solve problems. They do not create them. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service. And there's a picture here of Governor J.B. Pritzker signing the Children's Social Media Safety Act. The governor said the law, which takes effect in 2028, will provide common sense protections for young people. Let's turn the page over to Section A7, to the opinions section with J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. And there is a large and colorful picture of the statue of Founding Father Chaim Solomon. And it's shown in November of 2021 at the southeast corner of Pan Pacific Park in Los Angeles. The heading of the article is The Forgotten Founding Father. Saying founding fathers and the names pour forth, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, Patrick Henry and John Hancock, dozens of heroic figures whose vision and courage created the country we know today. Yet one name is usually missing, and it's a pity. Though he didn't thunder, give me liberty or give me death, and he didn't pen inspiring words such as, we hold these truths to be self-evident, his critical contributions made it possible for others to do so. Because without Chaim Salomon, Americans' independence might have ended as quickly as it had begun. Born into a Jewish family in what is now Poland in 1740, and fluent in several languages, Salomon traveled extensively in Western Europe. There he gained a keen understanding of international finance and how nations did business with one another, which he put to use in his career as a financial broker. When he was 30, deteriorating conditions in his homeland convinced him it was time to move, first to England and then to New York City, which had already cemented the status it retains as a financial capital. His arrival in the New World in 1775 coincided with the start of the Revolutionary War. As colonials were picking sides, Salomon immediately knew which cause held his heart. He joined the Sons of Liberty. Arrested in September of 1776 on suspicion of being a spy, he was quickly pardoned and then forced to serve 18 months on a British ship as a translator for German-speaking Hessian mercenaries. Meanwhile, he secretly aided the Patriot cause by helping Continental POWs escape. Nabbed again in 1778, the Brits charged him with espionage, but Salomon cheated the hangman by secretly slipping away. Settling down in Philadelphia, he went back to his profession as a financial broker, and that's where he truly made his mark. Salomon became acquainted with Robert Morris, the just appointed superintendent of finance of the United States, the revolutionary version of today's Treasury Secretary. They became a kind of dynamic duo of the business world. Morris had an immediate and almost overwhelming problem. The 13 colonies were both flat broke and needed money. Lots and lots of money. Salomon's expertise in international finance was just what Morris and the infant nation needed. Between his personal loans and fundraising, he provided more than $15 million in today's currency, money that kept his adopted country's cause afloat. However, his most vital service was yet to come. Salomon had picked up a side hustle that later proved invaluable when he became paymaster for all French forces in North America. Late in the war, France recognized America's independence, extended a huge cash loan, and, most important, sent its powerful navy and soldiers to bolster the Patriots. As summer drew to a close in 1781, the British Army, under General Lord Charles Cornwallis, became bottlenecked on a Virginia peninsula at Yorktown. Continental Army General George Washington sensed a strategic opportunity. If he could get his troops and the Allied French army to Yorktown, the combined forces could deliver a coup de grace that would end the war. There was just one problem, and it was a biggie. Washington's army was in New York's Hudson Valley just then. Moving its 350 miles to Virginia would cost a lot of money, and the Patriots' piggy bank was empty. Not low on funds, but flat broke. Washington knew what to do, and with one order changed the situation. Send for Chaim Salomon. Salomon swiftly rolled into action, brokering the sale of bills of exchange. The $20,000 he quickly raised made it possible for Washington's troops to redeploy and win the final triumph that fall. Salomon lived to see victory, but he didn't get to enjoy watching the country that he had helped create reach maturity. His unyielding generosity to the Patriot cause cost him all his money and likely damaged his health. He died suddenly and in poverty. In Philadelphia, just 6 days into 1785, he was only 44. His wife and four young children were left penniless. All the continental debts he had sunk his fortune into were now worth pennies on the dollar. He was quietly laid to rest in the cemetery of Philadelphia's Jewish synagogue and then faded from the nation's memory. Which is a shame, because Chaim Salomon was the founding father of who literally put his money where his mouth is. Continuing on to section A8, still under our communities, again from Springfield about Pritzker. This one is from the Capital News, Illinois. Pritzker signs bill allowing state to review insurance rates. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation Tuesday that will give the Illinois Department of Insurance authority to review and approve rate changes for homeowners and automobile policies. It's not asking too much to say to insurance companies, if you're telling your customers that rate hikes are necessary, you should be able to prove why. Pritzker said at a bill signing ceremony in Chicago. Prior to the bill signings, Illinois was one of only two states, along with Wyoming, that did not exercise regulatory control over insurance rates. The new laws, which take effect July 1st of 2027, prohibit companies from charging excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory rates and prohibit them from shifting the cost of losses in other states onto Illinois customers. The laws come a little more than a year after Illinois-based State Farm announced that it was raising homeowners' insurance rates, an average 27.2% statewide. They also come 2 years after Illinois motorists saw an average 18% hike in their auto rates, according to Secretary of State Alexei Giannoulias. In both cases, insurance industry officials said the rate increases were necessary due to inflation, the rising cost of repairs, and, in the case of homeowners insurance, the increasing frequency of extreme weather. In addition, State Farm recently noted that auto insurance rates have been falling in Illinois and that it lowered its premiums by an average of 15% in 2025. Insurance Department Director Ann Gillespie agreed that there are legitimate reasons for rate increases, but she said the new laws will help make sure that rate increases in the future are justified by reliable data. While no state legislation can fully eliminate these impacts to insurance premiums, these bills today hold insurance companies accountable for addressing their cost increases by requiring rates to reflect Illinois-specific losses and considerations, she said. House Bill 4273, the homeowners insurance bill, requires companies to give their customers 60 days' notice before raising premiums more than 10%. It also requires them to use credible state-specific claims data to develop their rate when it is available. But companies will be able to supplement that with national, regional, or out-of-state data if needed to meet actuarial standards of credibility. Companies will still be able to charge new rates once they are filed with the insurance department, but the new law will give the department authority to review those rates and order rebates of any excess premiums collected if the rates are found to be excessive or unfairly discriminatory. Senate Bill 714, the auto insurance bill, requires companies to give customers 30 days' notice before raising premiums more than 10%. It also gives the department authority to review rates and order rebates if the rates are found to be excessive or unfairly discriminatory. Giannoulias pushed for that bill, criticizing companies for basing rates on factors unrelated to a person's driving record, such as their credit score or zip code. But while these practices are not specifically prohibited in the final legislation, the new law does ban rates that are unfairly discriminatory. For far too many Illinois families, the cost of mandatory auto insurance has become absolutely unsustainable, forcing impossible choices between paying for coverage and paying for life's basic necessities, Giannoulias said at the bill signing ceremony. Insurance industry organizations, however, remain opposed to the new laws. In a joint statement issued after the bill signing, the Illinois Insurance Association, American Property Casualty Insurance Association, and National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies warned the new laws will lead to higher costs and fewer choices in the market because they do not address the economic realities behind premium increases. And continuing on this page under our communities, there is another opinion piece by Jim Dye with the heading, Giannoulias has bigger ambitions than just keeping current post. Alexei Giannoulias is running for re-election as Illinois Secretary of State in the November election, and in the spring of 2027, the election, too. Giannoulias, a Democrat, is running for mayor of Chicago. Whether he fulfills his four-year term as Secretary of State, he is a shoo-in. He's a shoo-in depends on what happens in the mayoral race. Clearly, he wants to be on a top dog in the Windy City and is confident that he will become just that. I would say I'm very proud of the coalition of support that we have built. And again, the only way to turn this city around is to have a coalition of people working together. Business, labor, elected officials, all of the above, he told an enthusiastic audience at Sunday's high-energy mayoral campaign announcement. Even by Illinois' tawdry standards, it's unusual to have a candidate running for two offices at the same time. But Giannoulias isn't the only one pulling off a twofer. U.S. Representative Mike Quigley, a Democrat from Chicago, is also running for re-election in November and mayor in the spring. There is, however, one big difference. If Quigley is elected mayor, a special election will be held in which voters will fill his House seat. If Giannoulias is elected mayor, however, there will be an election of sorts in which the winner needs just one special vote, that of the governor of Illinois. Most likely, that will be Governor J.B. Pritzker, the expected winner of his ongoing re-election campaign. In Illinois, the governor fills vacancies by appointment. Anyone remember when State Comptroller Judy Barr Topinka, at age 70, suddenly died from a strike, probably a stroke, in December of 2014, shortly after winning election to a four-year term? Then Governor Pat Quinn appointed Jeremy Sturmer, head of the governor's budget office, to fill the brief balance of Topinka's term. The newly elected Governor Bruce Rauner appointed businesswoman Leslie Munger to fill the new term to which Topinka had just been elected. Then there was the notorious effort by former Governor Rod Blagojevich to secretly sell Barack Obama's U.S. Senate seat after Obama was elected president in 2008. Giannoulias faces Republican Diane Harris in the race for Secretary of State. She is a retiree from Commonwealth Edison who has a union background and experience as an appointed library trustee and an elected community college trustee. But Giannoulias is heavily favored to win a second term to an office that he obviously doesn't want. Giannoulias is hoping winning the mayoral election will bail him out, and he's loaded with cash and has major labor union backing. But so far, at least, there are 10 mayoral candidates and others in the wings who may or may not get in or get out. That includes the city's current mayor, whose approval numbers could hardly be lower. The slew of candidates guarantees the two primary winners will capture a lower percentage of the vote in the primary. That means a candidate without widespread support but smaller fervid support can slip into the general election. That's how Mayor Brandon Johnson, a black man, defeated former Chicago school superintendent Paul Vallis, a white man, in a low turnout election in which he won overwhelming support from black voters. The tribal effect will be key as the elections play out. Vallis told the News Gazette that Giannoulias will absolutely be among the strong mayoral candidates, but he said there are so many unanswered questions and events yet to occur that the race is impossible to predict at this point. If Giannoulias somehow captures the crown, the behind-the-scenes race to capture Pritzker's Secretary of State appointment will be intense among the state's myriad Democratic wannabes. And I'm going to take a break now from our News Gazette, here our first half, and I will return shortly with the second half.